Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of Go, Go, Grow. If you're looking to scale your company and you're looking to find data, of course, everybody needs data. You're in the right place. I've got two exciting guests for you today. I have invited the founder and chairman of the board, as well as the CEO of Aurora WDC to join us today and share some amazing insight for you to get better information by asking better questions. So let me introduce Eric Johnson. He is the founder and chairman of the board. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Michelle. Great to be with you.
Awesome. Glad to have you here. We also have Derek Johnson. He is the CEO. Welcome, Derek.
Hi, Michelle. It's a real privilege to be here with you today.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you were both able to join us. So who doesn't want better answers? Do you know anybody?
I think most people in life are looking for better answers. And I think from our standpoint, it's not the answers that count. It's the questions you ask, because many of the answers that you're looking for are to the wrong questions.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we stress on Go, Go, Grow, and when I work with clients through Revenue Chasers, is you have to have data. But if it's bad data, or not the right kind of data, or incomplete data, you're not doing yourself any favors. And in fact, you may be doing yourself some harm. So let's talk for just a moment about Aurora WDC. Oh, Aurora Worldwide Development Corporation. It was founded to be a company to help market research, market intelligence, and give competitive information to companies.
Well, Michelle, thanks yeah. for asking about that. And I apologize. It is quite a mouthful. That's why we generally say Aurora WDC
instead
Worldwide Development Corporation. It's kind of long, but I would actually say that it was founded so that I could have a job. More specifically, within that next year or two, I discovered that there's a tremendously interesting and really, really endlessly interesting field known as strategic market and competitive intelligence, which I had never heard of before. And unfortunately, most people have never heard of it before and kind of flies beneath the radar a little bit. But I discovered this fascinating world that I felt would allow me to never get bored, essentially, and hopefully could be some living at it. And a few years after Endeavor, and we've been business partners ever since.
That's fabulous. And you know, the reason most entrepreneurs start their business, they need a job and they don't want to be bored. So you are right there in the thick of it with everyone else.
Right on.
Awesome. So the world of competitive intelligence, there's a big need. When you started the company, there may or may not have been a huge competitive field, but there's a huge need for every type of company to have every type of data. Derek, when you joined the company, what was your impetus for joining Eric and kind of filling that need?
Sure. Well, some of it was born out of some tragic circumstances. Our parents passed away. Our dad died in 1999, our mom in 01. And we looked at each other one day, I think it was probably over Thanksgiving of 02, and said, wouldn't it be cool if we were to try this thing together? You know what they say about having fun in life? It's always better if you have a buddy or someone to do it together. So, I had been pursuing what I still believe could have been a really fulfilling career in the investment management world, helping people find their own path around financial freedom. And I'm still passionate about that space, but I think it was always my calling to join Eric in this business. Now, as I look back almost 22 years in myself and 30 overall for the firm, we get to get involved in some highly creative, also sometimes highly unusual types of exercises that provide our client with information asymmetry. In other words, something that they can't find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's all governed through a code of conduct and a set of ethical standards that's important for everybody to maintain. But you can imagine what life in the mid-1990s as the advent of the internet and World Wide Web was coming about for Eric, you know, getting this business started. It had matured a little bit in that regard by the time I joined in 2003, but over the last 20 years in particular, especially since we've now about 19 years ago gotten into the software business, helping companies set up surveillance systems, monitoring competitors, customers, other market forces. Reality is, Michelle, we all have competitors, and sometimes we know who they are, but in many cases, we don't yet know who they are. And you have to watch for signals that are coming about, you know, in the spirit of this show, to essentially monitor who might be coming for your revenue. And if you don't have a way to do that, it can sneak up on you real quick.
Absolutely. And in fact, the biggest competitor oftentimes is the customer or potential customer either doesn't know you, they know you, but not well enough to select you, or they decide to do nothing. And a lot of that is because you don't know your customer well enough and you haven't asked those questions and you don't have that data to make data-driven decisions to reach that customer, give them the right message, and earn their business. It's interesting why we met. About almost a year ago, Jason Voyevich was a guest on Go, Go, Grow. And he is a marketer and a historian and an author, all kind of pulled into one. And his book talked about, and I'm going to get this mixed up here, I think it was Booze, Babe, and the Little Black Dress. I know those were the three components, but it may have been in the wrong order. But it was focused on how consumers have driven product marketing and how marketers, retailers, companies go out and reach their customers. He referred me to you because what you guys do and what Aurora WDC does is help companies reach those customers that are making those business driving decisions. So first of all, Jason, thank you for the introduction, but tell me how you work with like the Jasons of the world that use marketing to reach their customers or inform other companies.
You know, I met Jason for the first time. He was the keynote speaker at a university. Actually, Derek and Jason went to the same undergraduate school, University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, to the business school there. Jason got a degree in marketing, and I think yours was in finance, wasn't it, Derek? While you share that alma mater, I happen to be an advisor to their entrepreneurship program. This is going almost 20 years back. I think it's at least 15 years, probably pushing 20. Uh-huh. And I had been approached by a client of ours, still a client of ours. I won't say any more than that, who was attempting to design and put in place a reputation management function. And this was long before reputation management was really on anybody's corporate radar. This is a Fortune 100 company, so it's a very, very large organization. And I was approached to help them put that in place. And the first thing you find out in the competitive intelligence business is that you have to tell the truth. Yes. There is no such thing as fake it till you make it in this business. So when I was asked to help with this particular assignment, I told them I wasn't qualified. And they asked why. And I said, well, I don't know anything about reputation management. You know, why would you hire someone who doesn't know anything about the subject matter? And so I turned them down and they sort of made the rounds. They saw it as more of an intelligence problem to solve than a you know, brand and reputation problem to solve. And so they talked to a few of our traditional rivals and came back to me and eventually said, you know, you were the only one who said it wasn't going to be a piece of cake. I said, well, it's because it's not going to be a piece of cake. It's a very, very challenging assignment. It could take a year, you know, to get it up and running. And, you know, I don't even really know where to start, frankly.
Data.
They said, and, you know, they said, well, what would it take for us to get you to take the assignment? Basically, the credibility, in other words, the credibility that saying no. And, you know, I was still pretty hungry in those days. I'm still hungry. I'm hungry for every opportunity that comes across our transom, as is Derek, as is everybody in the company. We're tremendous hustlers. But I think that, you know, the right thing to do in those circumstances when you're not qualified is to step away. And I said the one thing I'd want to do is hire a subject matter expert, and it might take me a little while to find him. Well, of course, I had met Jason a couple of weeks prior at this meeting. I knew exactly who I wanted to bring in. I brought Jason into that assignment, and together, that was our first collaboration together. Fast forward a few years, we brought Jason in as our fractional chief marketing officer. He helped us through the biggest rebranding and repositioning of the company in its history back in the 2017-18 timeframe. Took almost 2 years to get that done. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and we had to sort of reorganize and cope through those times. But, you know, somebody like Jason, I think, is just a very, very empathetic, you know, innovator. Mm-hmm. He understands how innovation happens. And, you know, that's tangential to what competitive intelligence does. Many people think of competitive intelligence as a performance driving activity, when in fact, competitive intelligence is equally performance driving. Exploitative, I think, is one of the words that we'll use about, you know, pushing performance and getting higher returns.
Yeah.
What we might call the mercenary mindset, as well as the sort of exploratory side of things, figuring out what business you're going to be in a decade from now, and then making the kinds of capital allocation investments that are necessary today so that that business is viable a decade from now. And that really, in a nutshell, is the story of Aurora. It's why, you know, we're here 30 years later.
So you cracked open a big can of value there that I want to unpack. And I'm sure Derek has some things to add too. But you mentioned explore and exploit, and I want to talk about that. You also mentioned missionary. You are both co-authoring an exciting book called The Missionary and the Mercenary. And I was going to talk a little bit more in depth about that later, but definitely we want to tap into that because that is so critical, not only to who you are, individually, collectively, what you want to put out there as a legacy, but also has incredible insights from a business perspective for other entrepreneurs. So let's put a pin in that and definitely kind of recap our conversation, bringing that to the forefront. But you're absolutely right. Having just the data or just the marketing insight isn't enough. You've got to have both. So, Derek, do you want to kind of tackle what you guys mean by the explore and exploit phrase?
Sure. That's where I think the real magic of Eric's gifts and mine begin to align and ultimately overlap into what's created success, at least for us. And, you know, on that point of success, if the listener of this podcast is sitting there saying, well, everybody defines success differently. And of course, that's true. You're going to have to define success for what you're willing to tolerate and seek to achieve in the same way as Eric and I have for this business, up to and including, you know, a mutual understanding that we're not for sale. We're not looking for some type of exit event that's going to allow us to go live on some island somewhere. That's really not what this growth story of Aurora WDC is all about. And I think it's important to put it out there for people to understand that. That may not be the motivations of the leadership team that your listeners are seeing as their reality. We acknowledge that, yet I think that there's ways to capitalize on this explorer, exploiter, missionary, mercenary balanced mindset approach to business. I won't give it all away. We'll save some of it for the end of the podcast. Uh-huh. But when you think about somebody who is a little more operationally focused, like I might be, I might call that the exploiter capability. And you pair it with somebody who's got this innate ability to explore and discover new innovations for the business. And I say it all the time, without Eric's guts and grit as a newly minted 25-year-old in the winter of 1995, you know, we'd all be working elsewhere. That is true, but you know, you have to have good ideas that fuel the growth necessary to keep that growth story going. And I think that that's what's been so rewarding, at least for me, coming in about 8 years afterwards. But as we say in this book, I was there on day one. I helped put up the wall, shall we say, in our mom's beauty salon, which is a fun story unto itself. You have to have and surround yourself with people who can be both the discovery and explorer engines, with those who are going to exploit, you know, the product or service or capability that you're ultimately selling in order to derive the margin necessary to keep enough oxygen in the tank to keep your growth story going. And, you know, I think that for your listeners, just surrounding yourself with those people who can act and think and behave that way is probably my greatest recommendation. Sometimes those people are already before you. Other times you might have to go search for them.
Right, right. Or set the stage for those that come after you.
Right.
And a lot of that comes with gathering, my favorite word, data. So competitive intelligence, asking the right questions to get the right answer. And of course, if you ask the wrong question or miss a question or don't imagine that you're even going to need an answer, you're just doing yourself a disjustice. And it's not just from a marketing standpoint or a competitive intelligence standpoint. You need to know what's going on in your business. You need to know what's going on in your competitors, in the industry, in the world around you, for operations, for finance, for production, for strategic planning, for your tech stack and whatnot. So let's look specifically at marketing, because a lot of listeners will look at, okay, well, I'm trying to grow my company. And I think that revenue ecosystem, the sales, the marketing, the customer success, that's where I need to be.
Michelle, you asked the question about types of data, you know, and linking it back to your original point around marketing. With marketing, I think there's a type of data. It's really three subtypes of data that get represented in what we call the FUD factor approach: fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And ultimately, anybody particularly attached to a sales or revenue generation capability for their business, you have to find some way to insert enough FUD factor around your competition to get the attention of the buying party to say, I'm going to go with your offer versus somebody else's. And, you know, you create some uncertainty around their financial stability. You create some doubt around their product roadmap. You create some fear that some of their senior executives might be leaving the organization. Whatever that might look like is all data that you can use in your own efforts to grow.
Yeah, it has to be a flanking maneuver. You have to get them to ask questions without you drawing conclusions or making it's about influencing the actions of both the help as well as those who might hurt you. That's really what competitive, those can be planted, and you know, a customer can be trained to ask those questions, because they're things that they're back to right questions, better future, right? If we don't help them ask the right questions, they're certainly not going to come up with them on their own. So we have to help them introduce the fear, uncertainty, and doubt element completely organically from within themselves. And we have to do that in a way that is true. You know, they have to be actual concerns that we know are going to be important. And it's the reason why we've fortified those particular criteria ourselves.
I think that the takeaway here is it's not just asking the right questions so you have competitive intelligence and market data on how big the market is or what potential customers are looking for. These are how you sell better questions. So, like yeah. Eric just said, it's not about saying, well, do you know what the financial stability of that competitor you're looking at looks like? Why would you want to go with them? No, it's asking questions like, or sharing as part of your sales conversation, well, we have been steadily growing our technology base and customer base for the last 10 years with new innovations, you know, every 2 years. And we have such and such backing. So we are an extremely stable company. And I know that's important to you, Mr. Prospect, Mr. Customer, because your business success hinges upon the stability of this product. And I know that's an important concern for you.
Let me add on to that, actually, if I may. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Michelle. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let me add on, because you prompted something. The way I would probably draw attention to that, it's got to be based on your own self-examination and self-awareness. And I'll confess, Derek, tell me if this makes you uncomfortable, as I think it probably will. 20 years ago, there was a time at which one client was more than 50% of our revenue. Now, that isn't necessarily something that we're going to go out and try and brag about, but I will tell you that introduces substantial risk to enterprise survivability going forward when you've got such a big bump with your revenue stream. And so I would say that and put that in terms of, you know, Aurora takes very, very great pains to make sure that no single client represents more than 5% of our total top line revenue. That allows us to lose a client from time to time, as companies will, and not have it be an existential event every year. And so now I've planted the idea with you, Michelle and Derek. Boy, 5%, huh? Do you have more than 5% of your revenue with any single client? And when the other rival, our rival, presumably has to answer that question honestly, they're going to be put in a somewhat awkward position if they do. Now, if I know who we're up against, I'm going to tailor that list of questions so that we have the very best answers to those questions, and the people that we're up against do not, as exemplified by the last question.
So essentially, you're using your knowledge gained from asking the right questions to get the right answers to empower your sales team to position better questions to your current customers, your prospects, other thought leaders in the industry to better position you to grow your leadership, grow your revenue, cement your relationships. So it's precisely asking the right questions to leverage those answers.
And to make sure that the strengths that we have so diligently and painstakingly invested in are not only witnessed by the buyer or prospective buyer, they're appreciated by the buyer or prospective buyer and confer a preference to our offer over the functional equivalents under consideration.
Absolutely. Derek, do you have anything you want to add there? Maybe some of the ways that different functional areas of the company would use this type of expertise?
If I can get a cost structure covering 50% of the total turnover of the business, and that's covered in totality by the protect revenue that we're getting, that gives me the chance for the other half of my time to go out there and try to explore and exploit new opportunities, selling new products or services to existing customers in that go-get middle category of revenue. Mm-hmm. And then the far right column would be about 20% of your effort under this particular model, being able to go out there and hunt for new deals, whether that's attending trade shows you've never gone to, writing thought leadership that appears in places that it's never appeared before, taking a chance on a piece of collateral, perhaps like what Eric and I are doing with this book, that will get people really thinking and attaching to your brand in ways that they haven't before. You know, there's ways to break it down, and the 50, 30, 20 is not a hard and fast rule, of course, but it might be a model for your listeners to think about and then tailor it and its appropriate allocations to the style of business that they have.
Can I add one thing to what Derek just said? And that is that 50% and I'll use the term break even point. You know, if your cost structure break even, that's your profitability line. That's basically the waterline. You're going to have a really hard time investing in anything innovative if you're underwater. You're going to have to take outside capital in order to do it. You're going to lose control of the business. You're going to not be there very much longer, unfortunately. And I think that's true of speaking as a historian, 95% of new enterprises, that's their 5-year time horizon. They're 95% of them, the original founding team is out. For those last few who do, I think they focus on that break-even point and they make sure that break-even is very firm so that they aren't going to be underwater as they try and take these more exploratory investment strategies. And, you know, when the Fortune 100 company says, can you help us build this thing that no one's ever built before? And you say, no, I don't know how to do it. What will it take you to get to do that? I'm going to need an expert who can come in. And then you figure out a joint venture with somebody like a Jason or with you or with someone else who has been brought into our path to help us do things that we don't know how to do yet. And I think that's really, you know, in a knowledge economy, which we've been in now really since Aurora's got its start 30 years ago. That's really, it's all about learning. It's all about saying, you know, I don't know how to do that yet, but I bet I can learn. And I know that if I can't figure it out within 30 days, I should probably cut bait and find something else.
Well, that's why people are listening to podcasts such as Go, Go, Grow or other resources that they take advantage of, because saying, I don't know this, I'm not the expert at this because my brain is full of knowledge about this, which I am the expert of. That is not a sign of weakness. That's saying I am smart enough to know that there's somebody out there better at this that's going to, when we combine our efforts, we're going to be exponentially more successful.
Yeah.
So when you have an entrepreneur, small business person, somebody who's doing a scale up of their company, when they reach out and say, hey, I need to bring in this expert, they are doing immeasurable good for their company. So thank you everyone for listening and realizing that the guests that I bring on and the value that I add is going to impact your opportunity for success. So thank you to listeners. But there are just a couple other things I want to make sure that we speak about. First of all is the concept of the chisel tip. Now this is a bit of a complex concept. And I want to put the graphic up. And if we can just kind of do a high level, what I'd like to do with your permission is put the graphic and a more detailed explanation in the show notes. But I'd love to walk through it, having you guys explain it since it's your design and your knowledge source. But I don't want to spend 20 minutes on that because I really want to talk about one other thing. And of course, the missionary and the mercenary. So can we talk about the chisel tip?
Yeah. Would you like me to take it away, Derek? You jump in. So this isn't actually original to us. I'll say that I saw this graphic probably 20 years ago, but it was two dimensions, not three. And the two dimensions were that if you had an object floating in space and you had one side of the object is triangular and the other side of the object was rectangular, and you shine a light on that object, the triangular side is going to produce a triangular shadow. And from 90 degrees, a rectangle will cast a rectangular shadow. And so I really kind of, you know, I thought that was kind of cool. But it wasn't until I saw the third perspective, which was, what if you did that with a rod rather than a box? And instead of slicing off the two hooves of the triangle and from a box, you used a rod to do that. And you sliced off the two sides of the rod and then sliced it off right at the base of that triangle. Now there's a triangle shadow being cast, a rectangular shadow being cast. And then from the top down, it's a circular shadow being cast. And that was really when it hit home for me, that the truth is the chisel tip. The truth is the object itself. But there are contradictory observable criteria or conditions about that truth, which are all true, even though they seem paradoxical, may seem to cancel each other out, may seem to be impossible that they can all be true at the same time. And that, for me, really crystallized what human intelligence is all about. And we're very specific about, you know, talking about Aurora WDC as the human intelligence company. We are powered by humans. We are machine augmented human intelligence analysts, however. So we use machines and software to make that human intelligence mission much, much faster, higher yielding, less frail, more complete, to make sure that we don't miss something. Humans, I think, are where all the errors come from in an algorithmic system. And so making sure that machines are used to reduce the propensity of human error and enhance the bandwidth by which humans can operate is the principle we operate under. So the chisel tip really represents how paradoxical true statements, which seem to be impossible to reconcile. And I find this, I'm a collector of paradoxes, by the way, as a philosopher, that's my sort of sub field of philosophy is I love to collect paradoxes, because wherever you see a paradox, and this is for the entrepreneurs who are listening to Go Grow here today, Michelle, where you see paradoxes exist, that's like X marks the spot. There's a pile of gold underneath that paradox, because other humans haven't figured out how to reconcile the fact that these two contradictory statements are both true. What's the truth at the core? So that's my 5-minute version of the chisel tip. Derek, what did I miss in that explanation?
Well, I this is going to change the complexion of that analogy a little bit, but I've got 4 kids, and in almost any given hour of the day, non-school hours, at least 2 of them are in some type of quarrel with one another. And I like to explain the chisel tip in a slightly different way, a little more real life, maybe analogy here. If they get in a quarrel, there's essentially 3 versions of the truth. Mm-hmm. There's the first child's, there's the second child's, and there's the actual truth. And if you have the power to shine the light on all 3, you'll be better off. You'll have stronger data to make a decision or base your reaction to who got who in trouble or what product innovation is going to help drive the next round of sales success here. I don't care what the scenario might be, but the chisel tip itself allows you to think about where within that ecosystem you really need to shine the light in order to expose the truth that's going to translate those insights into action. And I think that that's a really big component of what all of us as humans do every hour of every day. You know, we're just looking for, like Eric said, those paradoxes that can be exploited and ultimately use them to drive, you know, a more fulfilling professional life, a more fulfilling personal life, whatever it might be.
I love that. Absolutely love that analogy. And Eric, I've got another paradox for you. Going back to what you just said about AI or the machine eliminates the human error. So the machine eliminates the human error. But when it comes to Gen AI, the human proofreads and eliminates the Gen AI error. So.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. In other words, when you task a generative AI to produce something, a fast draft of something, for example, like write me a pitch for company X, you know, for product offer C. You know, if you're trying to do that, the first version of that that comes back is probably going to be pretty rough, and the human's going to have to perfect that. I think that you've illustrated something we call the knowledge funnel, and it's a design thinking principle that suggests that it requires a lot of human effort to take a mystery and derive heuristics for manipulating that mystery, and to use algorithms in the heuristic development process is not impossible, but it's often counterproductive because you often have to rework it. In other words, you're asking the wrong question. You ask the wrong question.
There you go.
And you got an answer that's irrelevant as a result of asking the wrong question. So what we'll generally say instead is the knowledge funnel is really the process of removing human effort from an algorithm until that algorithm is perfectly reliable. Until it's made perfectly reliable, you're not really focusing on reliability. You're focusing on viability, that this is a viable thing that can work in the world and can actually manipulate that mystery in a way that's predictable, because without predictability, you can't write an algorithm. You'll write an algorithm that has a million exceptions to it, and that's not an algorithm. So I haven't really answered your question there, Michelle, I realize, but you know, I think the use of generative AI for some of these tasks and workloads are really designed to we call it defeating the blank page. And actually, our ghostwriter on the book, that is her specific mission. Her specific mission is to defeat the blank page. And when you're looking at an empty sheet of paper saying what needs to be on this sheet of paper for this person that I'm producing it for, it's immensely helpful for a human to have a draft to work off of. And that's really the principle, I think, that, you know, is kicking in when you use that example.
Right. And a lot of entrepreneurs, small business owners, and anyone who is limited bandwidth, they can really benefit from Gen AI, but they maybe either don't utilize it or improperly utilize it because they don't understand it. And that's just as dangerous as anything else. This was kind of an interesting little segment that we did. And I do have another episode. It's recorded, just hasn't been released yet, on using Gen AI in your go-to-market. So once that one's released, I'll put that one on the episode notes as well. But I want to quote something back to you, Eric. What inevitable mistake made that contender the inevitable loser?
Yeah. Well, you know, a few years ago, I would describe myself as a historian who pretends to be an entrepreneur and businessman. You know, the thing that really intrigues me about history and the study of the past, it's all over the place, very eclectic interests in that domain. And I was sitting at dinner one night with a bunch of the folks from our Council of Competitive Intelligence Fellows, which I just got back from that meeting in Denver. Derek was the president of that organization in 2023, actually very proud of my baby brother and his leadership role there. And I was out at that meeting last week or week before. And this didn't happen there, but about 10 years ago, I was having dinner with a group of these very, very bright, intelligence analysts. And I was describing this history interest of mine. And someone asked the question, you know, well, what is it you'd say is you sort of your specialty? What's your big interest? And somebody else at the table said, and I don't remember who it was, said, losers. You love losers. That's what they all have in common. You know, whether that's the Roman Empire or, you know, presidential politics or American foreign policy before the, you know, Civil War, all these weird, you know, eclectic historical interests. And I said, you know, that's dead on. And in fact, the reason I'm interested is I want to reverse engineer what happened with each of the contenders that caused their inevitable loss, because they didn't enter the contest assuming they were going to lose. Nobody does that. No one enters a contest knowing they're going to lose. They enter a contest believing in their ability to win, and even believing in the superiority of their ability to win over the other competitor or competitors. And so what was it? What was the mistake that happened there? And as we I spent about the last 10 years thinking about that and sort of reverse engineering that into a system that actually Derek and I refer to as superiority analysis, because achieving superiority in the market is always determined by the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. You can't determine that you're superior. Your customers determine that you're superior based upon the criteria and how that criteria aligns with what they will exchange for their share, their market share. And so as we reverse engineered the system of superiority, that became the principal doctrine and tradecraft of the missionary and the mercenary, which is, what are the satisfiers that the market absolutely demands but will not reward you beyond the threshold of expected performance? It has to meet that threshold. If it goes beyond, it's waste. And then what are the drivers? A driver is a criterion that will induce a switch. It'll cause them to choose you over someone else, or it'll cause them to choose someone else over you if you're underperforming in that criterion. And then finally, the third criteria is disruptor. The disruptor is a criterion which no one expected to see, but once they see it, everyone has to have it. And that method of thinking about offers in the market, and the reason we say offer and not offering, is because the offer is contextual to how the customer can appreciate it. So the offer is, you know, grande upside down. What's your drink that you get at Starbucks, Derek? Tell me what that is.
I'm not very good at saying it, but venti ice, caramel macchiato, upside down, easy ice.
There you go. So that's very specific criteria that's contained in that thing. And there are certain times of day when my kid brother's going to want that from Starbucks, and other times of day when he's not. And so the offer is contextual to Derek's ability to reward that offer with his share of the market. And he's a share of one. He's one buyer out of millions, at least for Starbucks. So in thinking about the offer, always puts the focus on the customer. It's always the focus on the best stuff. None of that matters because the customer doesn't care about any of that stuff. That's all just BS. The customer needs alignment with their superiority criteria, and lacking that alignment, they'll buy it from somebody else.
Interesting. So
I think that the only thing I would add to that as it relates to maybe us making this leap into why we're writing this book, Michelle, if we're about to go there.
Yes.
In the podcast. I actually looked it up. Believe it or not, we have a Miss Piggy quote in our book that reads as follows. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and it may be necessary from time to time to give a stupid or misinformed beholder a black eye. So, you know, we grew up kind of watching Miss Piggy. This book is filled with what I think, Eric, you would agree, pretty interesting quotes, case studies, both corporate and individual. In fact, I won't bury the lead totally, but in our final chapter that'll drop on Substack next week, we actually invoke Ebenezer Scrooge, maybe a little prelude to holiday time coming up. You know, when you think about what I liked about what you said here, Eric, is these paradoxes and these satisfier, driver, and disruptor criteria. Every one of you that's listening to this podcast now or at some point in the future, you work for companies where you're already doing that. You know, you know that either you're functionally equivalent or you're ahead of the competitor in the various product or service dimensions that make you successful. Our point in this book is that you can get more intentional about that to serve the short term as well as the long term, the pragmatic as well as the ideal or idealism driven side of your business. And that's what I'm excited about after 2.5 years of co-authoring this book with Eric, having Wanda, our ghostwriter, help us defeat the blank page. And ultimately, it's in tribute to our parents. You know, I think that is one of the big whys behind this book, mm-hmm. is that they may have died fairly young, but we know that they'd be proud of us for not just venturing down this path of working together for so long, but having a hell of a lot of fun doing it and helping really great brands kind of work through what data is necessary for them to get to or remain successful, and how to just think differently about the industries, the clients they serve, and other aspects of their business to help them stay there.
That's a good summary. That is an excellent summary. And as Derek mentioned, the book is being released chapter by chapter on Substack. So we will put a link to that in the show notes as well. Again, it's called The Missionary and the Mercenary. Do either of you want to add anything overall to our conversation today?
I'll just thank you, Michelle, for having us on here today. It's always fun to chat with people that I haven't had a long form conversation with like this before. So you ask really great questions yourself. Thank you for all the great questions. And, you know, I never turned down an opportunity to appear with my kid brother on things either. So thank you, Derek, for tolerating your big brother like this. I think I'll just say that, Derek talked about the idealist and the pragmatist. And I think we all want to be idealistic about the things in our lives and really serve those higher, better angels, so to speak, or higher callings. But oftentimes, if you don't be pragmatic about, getting things done, you don't get to eat tomorrow. And so that's where the pragmatism side comes in. And, the missionary is the idealist who wants to see the world in a more perfect version than it currently inhabits, and doesn't care if it happens in their lifetime. In fact, they assume that it won't. And so I have a deep missionary sensibility about, my life here on earth and what'll happen when I'm gone and, all of that stuff, all the sort of spiritual side of life. But also, what I've been called to do, what my highest calling is. And that highest calling is something that no one else can do. That's unique to me. I have to fulfill that highest calling, but there's also a great calling. And that great calling is the purpose and mission of my life. And I would urge everybody who listens to your podcast, Michelle, to dig into that. Ask that question about yourself. What is your great calling? What is the great calling that no one else can do but you? And then what's your highest calling? What have you been sort of recruited to do to serve? And then figure out where the mercenary shows up. The mercenary shows up at very interesting points along the path. And the mercenary is always thinking about getting things done. The mercenary is thinking about winning. And without that mercenary side, I know a lot of idealistic missionaries who are very unhappy because they've been so very much focused on that calling that they can't make any money at it. And unfortunately, that's one of the keys, I think, in reverse engineering the loser. It's not that you're a loser because you don't find your inner missionary. It's a loser because you can't balance the two perspectives that you inherently have as a human being. All humans have this two sides of themselves. And, you know, we actually have tried to turn the term duplicity into a virtue. Duplicity means to have two faces. Right. And the two faces of the missionary and the mercenary are absolutely essential. I think duplicity is often seen as saying one thing and doing another, or stabbing people in the back and that sort of thing. And
Well, saying one thing and doing another is not the same thing as stabbing someone in the back. Yeah, it's not the same thing.
Right. Being negative, and it's not. But you must figure out how to inhabit both sides of yourself and balance it in a way that allows you to both get things done and do the big things in the world that you want to accomplish. So
I think I would just leave you, Michelle and Eric, it's also been a pleasure to be on this podcast with you as well. Always, as always, you know, with the following statement and then a couple of questions.
Yeah.
In this book, you know, well, let me go back.
Yeah.
For most of my life, up until the point we got into this book, I thought that there was basically two versions of control. In Stoicism, it'd be called the dichotomy of control, meaning there's two of them. Either I control that situation or I don't, and that's just how it is. Well, competitive intelligence is about the act of influencing others' control over situations. So there's actually a trichotomy of control. We call it the trichotomy of control factors in this book. And that's been really eye-opening for me as it relates not just to business, but to life in general. I got to cope with and survive it. I have to accept the fact that somebody else has exclusive governance over that control, or I can influence it in some way so as to try to, in Eric's words, be a little bit duplicitous about it and ultimately tried to influence what would serve me the best at the end of the day. But the two questions I would ask, and channeling Eric, your greatest contribution, I think, to the conclusion of this book is the following. Who am I trying to impress and who am I trying to please? That's a different way of saying, you know, great calling and highest calling. You know, and if you can answer those two questions as it relates to your professional aspirations, I'll call that a win.
I'll call that freedom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. It's been a very eye-opening and informative, inspirational conversation. I'm sure all of our listeners gained a lot of information from this session today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the opportunity, Michelle. It's been fun.
Absolutely. Thank you again, both, for being on the show. And thank you for watching Go, Go, Grow. I invite you all to check out The Missionary and the Mercenary. I will include a link to Substack on the show notes. Please do check it out. It's going to be a fantastic book. I also invite you to get in touch with me if you'd like some help asking those right questions so that you can get the right answers. It's going to make your business go, go, grow. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.